You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Ted Cruz steamrolls the Republican race in Iowa, while Bernie Sanders nips at Hillary Clinton's heels.
Tonight is a victory for every American who's watched in dismay as career politicians in Washington, in both parties, refuse to listen and too often fail to keep their commitments to the people.
It's an election climate where it seems that anything goes. But beyond the noise and distractions, what were Iowa voters really saying? Plus, the UK is a step closer to striking a deal on EU reforms, and it's apparently good news for the Brits. We'll look at how the rest of Europe might fare. And later on, if you've ever dreamed of owning a struggling Russian airliner, you might be in luck as the Kremlin prepares for a privatisation bonanza. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London, and the former British diplomat John Everard. John and Kathleen, thank you for joining us today. Now, if American elections were decided by the amount of media coverage a candidate receives, there's little doubt we'd now be looking forward to a Trump White House. Thankfully, the process is rather more complex, exceedingly complex, it turns out, as voters in Iowa demonstrated yesterday. Despite repeatedly boasting of poll numbers that defy the laws of gravity, Donald Trump lost to Ted Cruz in the Iowa caucus. You could almost call him a loser. The small middle American state is far from an accurate preview of things to come, but it does serve as a timely reminder that the Republican nominee is far from decided. Now, Kathleen, before Ted Cruz gets... No, in fact, we'll talk about Ted Cruz in a moment. Let's just enjoy this moment for just a little bit. Donald Trump lost, didn't he?
Yes, in all sorts of ways. He lost because he came in second, and he lost because he was seen as unstoppable. And the mystique of the Donald has been punctured a bit. And it was clear that he saw that as well, although he did say he still loved Iowa.
He said he'd buy a farm there.
Yeah, I know.
God, I'm not sure if he will.
What a threat. He wants a bit of those ethanol subsidies, I should have thought.
John Everard, it was a huge defeat for a man who had gone to great lengths to talk about how well he was doing in the polls, how much people loved him. Obviously, you know, some people, myself included, are quite happy about that. Do you think there is a way back for him, though?
Well, yes, this is just one primary, one caucus. There's a long way to go. There are lots of occasions of people who've lost the first primary and gone on to win the presidency. So, yes, there will be a ways back. Just how sorry... I mean, I am not sorry that Donald Trump has lost. I am sorry that Ted Cruz has won. I think there's a hidden premise in a lot of the media comments that are coming out, which is that Ted Cruz is less mad than Donald Trump. I think this requires close examination. I think that Donald Trump says the most outrageous things, and if he ever translated half of what he says into policy, I think the United States would go into meltdown. But his track record of what he's actually done when he's had power in his various businesses has been quite different. He's taken quite reasonable decisions and been quite effective at running very large organizations. Ted Cruz, on the other hand, his rhetoric is much more restrained, but the way he's actually voted, the things he's actually done through a long political career, leave my blood running cold.
But that's why it makes a lot of evangelical Americans' blood run hot, because he has, well, he says ideology is more important than policy. Where have we heard that lately? Perhaps over here, that it's more important to be right than to actually govern, if you see what I mean. And he certainly has run for that. He almost single-handedly brought the U.S. government to a grinding halt. In fact, in defense of his ideological wishes. The thing about Cruz is that everyone who knows him in Washington detests him.
Not a single senator has backed him. Not a single one of the people who actually work with him.
Yeah, they think he's a, well, he's an unguided missile. He's rogue. They see him as someone who is so self-obsessed and does nothing but sort of grandstand and will sacrifice anything and everything around him to achieve what he wants. I mean, the thing is that what one can see happening there is because Super Tuesday is by far mostly Southern states, evangelical states. One can see Cruz, if he, you know, he'll shovel off South Carolina because he won't do that well there. But one can imagine you have Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, a lot of those. One can imagine him racking up the delegates.
And yet it's interesting. If you look at the odds, which tend to be in some ways a little more accurate than polls, where the money actually goes. If you look at the odds today, Ted Cruz is third favourite to become the Republican nominee. Donald Trump is the second favourite. But the runaway favourite, evens, you can so the money's not good on him at all, is the man who came third, Marco Rubio.
Winning from becoming third, that is quite an unusual achievement in the United States, in fact.
Yes, it is. I mean, I'd like to think that the money's smart. I mean, far rather Marco Rubio, for all his various idiosyncrasies, than either Ted Cruz or Donald Trump. But I have to agree. I think, you know, his chances are frankly not great.
Hmm. When you look at how this primary's worked so far for the Republicans, Kathy, there has been a lot of anger from Republican primary voters from the grassroots on the Republican side. And now we've seen that before. We saw that 4 years ago when there was a cast of thousands that at some stage was top of the polls. It was Herman Cain, it was Newt Gingrich. People laugh at the idea of Herman Cain, but he really was top of the polls at some stage.
The Pizza King, was he not?
Indeed, he was the Pizza King. But we are, you know, eventually the Republican establishment re-established itself, and Mitt Romney was the nominee in the same way as John McCain was the nominee before him, in the same way as George W. Bush was before that. And in fact, you have to go back very far, all the way to Barry Goldwater in the 60s, to find a candidate who's, you know, a Republican candidate who was not the mainstream Republican Party's choice. Do you think we can see a new Goldwater this time? Could Ted Cruz actually do it? Or do you think we'll revert to the norm?
It depends on what Goldwater had was a lifetime of Republican county-level activists, states all over the place. I mean, he had been their darling for 20 years, 25 years. Cruz has not yet had the time to build up that sort of, I mean, truly grassroots, almost elder, all over the place. I'm not putting my money on anything, but I don't think Cruz will end up at the end. Too many people detest him. His organization, incredible on the ground, retail voting, retail vote collecting, every one of those 91 precincts he went through. You cannot do that all over the United States. It's a big place.
Interestingly, John, one man who will hope that Ted Cruz continues to do well is arguably Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders, as we saw last night, it was in a pretty much a statistical tie with Hillary Clinton. There were some precincts which went down to a coin toss. Strangely enough, that's democracy. Apparently, Hillary won all six of them. So
yeah,
you know, you want your president to be lucky.
Money does matter in politics.
She's the person.
The double-headed coin. Yes.
But John Everard, for Bernie Sanders, his big downside is if the Democrats think, OK, the Republicans have got a serious candidate who can appeal to the centre. He will want Ted Cruz to be in there for the long haul, won't he?
I'm not so sure. I think that, I mean, Sanders' great appeal is as the populist demagogue, as the man who's going to break the system, reform it, throw out all the cronies, all the political dynasties, you know, just reform American politics. And I think for him, what he would be looking for would be a mainstream establishment Republican candidate to start saying rude things about. I think if it came to a choice between him and Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, come to that, you'd have two candidates saying actually rather similar things, but from different political perspectives, from the right and from the left. Both demagogues, both iconoclasts, and both saying they're going to wreck the system rather than work within it. I suspect that Bernie Sanders would prefer a more mainstream opponent.
Of course, that's when Michael Bloomberg says he'll come in. Mm. That if there's two, if the two on the main parties are too extreme on the right or the left, he can come in and hoover up the center.
That's not going to happen, though, is it?
Probably not.
A, he's not going to stand. And B, even if he were to, it's, you know, well, the history of third-party candidates.
Ross Perot, for example. And, of course, Ralph Nader, who famously denied or handed George W. Bush the Florida votes and the presidency.
Only by picking up 2 or 3% of the vote, but it was in some parts a crucial 2 or 3%. John, let's look then at the Democratic race in a bit more detail. Do you think that Hillary's very, very, very narrow victory is the moment where the Democratic Party thinks, okay, we've had our fun, we've dallied with the socialist, we're going back now with the person who we think can win? Or do you foresee this being a long struggle over the next 2 months?
I would hesitate to lay money either way, but if I had to, it would be for the first option. I think.
Really?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of anger behind the votes for Bernie Sanders. This was pure protest. It was not so much a vote for Sanders as a vote against Clinton and all that Clinton stands for, because one of the great political dynasties and about as establishment as you come. I suspect that munching through their breakfast cornflakes the day after the result, a lot of Democrats will be asking themselves, okay, we protested. Do we actually want this man in the White House? Do we want them out of hand? It's very useful for voicing our frustration with the system, but is this the person we want to put up against the Republicans, and does this person really represent our values?
The problem there, of course, is that it's only those under the age of 39 who are going to be saying that, because Clinton got by far the majority of those in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and Sanders' majorities by 84 to 16, if you're under age 29. His all came in the first half of life, as it were, those who are on the way to growing up as opposed to growing down. The difficulty is those on the way to growing up don't vote as much as those on the way to going, the older voter are the ones who vote. So what he has to do, and he will say, I did it in Iowa, I'm going to do it in New Hampshire, but whether he's going to be able to do it in 15 states the same time on the 1st of March for Super Tuesday is problematic. It's unlike Cruz, who has the possibility, because that his states that like him are coming up early. Sanders is going to have a problem because New Jersey is late, and New York is late, and California is late. The East and West Coast large states are late.
Well, and also Ted Cruz has the advantage, John Everard, that he is not up against the Republican version of a Clinton. If Jeb Bush, who I think got
2.3%.
There was one precinct with 700 people in the room where the person running the precinct said, okay, who wants to speak up for Jeb Bush? No one raised their hand out of 700 people. Jeb Bush's campaign is, in some trouble, John, it's fair to say. And that has helped Ted Cruz, hasn't it? There isn't this inevitable candidate that he is having to be up against.
Well, yes, it's helped him and it's hindered him. It's helped him in the sense that he's not confronting one of these fantastically well-oiled political machines, the kind that would have whirred into action had Jeb Bush's candidacy ever got traction. It hinders him in the sense that it would be very useful, I think, to Ted Cruz to have an establishment candidate to throw brickbats at and to be generally rude about, which, of course, is something that Ted Cruz excels at. He's actually hasn't got much of a target right now.
So in terms of, would you actually say that Ted Cruz would have preferred it if he had an establishment candidate to, he's pretty much saying he's running against the establishment. As we heard at the top of the show, it's all about how, both parties in Washington have been, have held us back. We can't rely on anyone. I'm the outsider.
Would he have preferred it? Don't know. I think that's difficult to call. But it does leave him in the rather odd position of raiding, as you rightly say, against the establishment with a capital E, as a kind of abstraction. All this group of faceless people who keep doing bad things to ordinary Americans. And I suspect that there's quite a lot of him that would have liked a hate figure to come out of the political process that he could actually point fingers at, rather than just this rather loose group.
Okay, we will leave it there. We'll be discussing Iowa and indeed looking ahead to New Hampshire on the Monocle Daily a little bit later. Thomas Lewis is reporting for us in Iowa today. Our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, will also be there. That's in about 4 hours' time. Now, leaders across the European Union have spent today working their way through 16 pages of proposed reforms to the UK's membership of the EU. The aim is to make the union a little more attractive to British voters ahead of the upcoming referendum, with the main concerns being competitiveness, Eurozone governance, national sovereignty and welfare benefits for people in the EU moving to the UK. The UK's Prime Minister, David Cameron, says he thinks the reforms represent real progress and has said that this is a deal he is willing to support. John Everard, he has returned home from Europe waving his piece of paper saying he has peace in our time.
Well, oh dear, what a comparison. Not quite. I think, of course, having fought so hard to get this deal, he's got to say that it's peace in our time, to take your resonant phrase. But I think he must realise that it's going to be a hard sell within his own party, let alone within the country at large. It's also going to be quite a hard sell within Europe. Already we've got leaders coming out of other European countries saying, where this is going to be a bit difficult for us. The really tricky bit, I think, is going to be the question of benefits for what David Cameron keeps calling migrants. Everybody else, calls freely moving workers within the EU. And although the Polish government agrees with the British government on a whole range of issues, it often says it's that Britain's the only country that shares its vision of European security. It would be political suicide for a Polish government to agree a paper that stops that many, many Poles working in the UK from claiming benefits. I mean, you'd have an evaporation of political support if you did that. So there's a battle there to be fought as well.
Well, indeed. And you look at actually how it's referred to. Originally, the UK was saying they wanted a ban for 4 years of anyone from the European Union who wasn't British coming here to get any sorts of benefits, including in work benefits. But now it's an initial complete exclusion, but gradually increasing access to such benefits to take account of the growing connection of the worker with the labour market. Now,
which is a brilliant phrase, meaning absolutely nothing. It means that point has got to be negotiated still.
Yes, I mean, the point is when you're going to negotiate, you put on the table, it's like being a trade unionist, what you really would like to achieve, but you know you're going to have to back off a bit. I mean, the best, I don't think John will disagree when I say the best agreement is one in which both sides can claim victories. Mm. You can't have an unconditional surrender.
But those agreements are hard to sell, aren't they? Particularly if you have a population which, David Cameron obviously is worried about here in the UK, that is sceptical of anything that comes from Europe. And if he says, look, I asked for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things and I've come back with sort of half on two of them.
I think it's a much more positive one than that, I must say. I too tried to skim through the 16 pages before coming in here. The best one could. Fortunately, it had lots of white space around and not single space thin. For example, on the benefits, it says, one problem was child benefits, that if you were Polish and the father worked here, he could send all the child benefits back to Poland on English terms. And what that says, well, you send them back to the limit in their own country. In other words, child benefits only to the extent that Poland would pay child benefits. Well, that may sound picayune-ish, but it does mean that he can say he has done what he can do with that. And that's just one of, a dozen of those.
Indeed. John, do you think the debate now switches from the minutiae, and obviously that those that want Britain to leave will stick very much on the minutiae and say, well, you said this, but actually this happened, to a more general look? It is far better for us to be in the European Union than not be in it for these reasons. A more sort of general talk rather than the nitty-gritty of this deal.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think, There's a sense in which this paper actually doesn't matter that much. People in many places in Parliament have already decided which way they're going to go. And there's no way, there's nothing that Cameron Corbyn brought back from Brussels that was going to satisfy people like Lam Fox.
The paper itself is important. What's in it isn't.
Yes, exactly. This is gesture politics on a rather grand scale in some ways.
But it's made good gestures, hasn't it? It says that if you really don't want it, you don't have to do it, fundamentally, is what it says. That for example, you may not, if you're not part of the euro, okay, the euro people can't tell you what to do, but you can't tell them what to do. I mean, it's drawn various boundaries in a way that were quite fuzzy before, I think. And that's not such a bad thing.
No, that's right. Actually, the euro brings me on to another point I wanted to make, if I may. We're talking about possible opposition to this. I think there's another side to the whole debate, which is the number of governments in the EU who are not going to sit their head above a parapet right now, but who are actually rather sympathetic to what Cameron is trying to achieve. Not everybody in the EU feels the cause of ever closer integration in their bones. The Dutch, the Danes, the Swedes, I mean, a lot of Northern Europe will be looking at this document and quietly saying, actually, this guy's talking quite a lot of sense. And this, I think, is one of the things that worries Juncker, worries the Commission, worries the integrationists, that it's not just about the UK. This is a bandwagon, and who knows where it's going to go.
And on the issue of the referendum, which is probably going to be around 23rd of June, give or take, we'll see whether this deal goes through in the next couple of weeks. But when people come to vote, those that were a little bit sceptical will look at the fact that David Cameron is backing it, that George Osborne is backing it, that Theresa May is almost certainly going to be backing it, that Boris Johnson is almost certainly going to be backing it as well. And I think, well, look, these people are not Euro enthusiasts, and they're saying that on balance, this isn't a bad thing for Britain. That's going to help those that want to stay in, won't it?
Well, yes, and it's also going to help those who don't feel strongly but think on the whole it's probably marginally better or marginally safer. I think inertia is a very strong thing, that people know what they've got. And, you know, it's not precisely the devil you know, but hold on to the nurse for fear of finding something worse.
Yes, precisely. And remember, I mean, if the economic forecasters are right, by the time this referendum comes round, the UK economy is not going to be glowing quite as bright as it is right now. People are going to be feeling a certain amount of economic stress. And when people get nervous about their economic prospects, they tend to become much more risk-averse than they normally are. And I think, you know, hold on to nurse will be something of a mantra we're going to hear a lot of in this referendum campaign.
The Belloc doctrine.
Yes.
And Cathy, also, when you look at how this will be thought about in Europe, on the whole, most European governments will be thinking, well, thank God this is over and we can move on back to the issues that actually really matter, like the state of our economy, the future of the euro, what on earth to do about refugees.
Yes, but also they will be thinking, I suspect, thank God Britain is here. I mean, we historians are only too well aware, you know, of the period in the 50s and the 60s where countries like the Netherlands were desperate because Britain's skeptical democracy was what they needed as a barrier or as a counterweight to what was becoming, everyone could see, a dominant, huge Germany. And so therefore, that feeling that you need Britain in as a counterweight, I think, is also going to exercise.
But John, on that point, and you know, I share Kathleen's analysis there, but there's only been a very brief period where Britain has acted as that counterweight, you know, arguably a bit in the 80s, certainly during Tony Blair's time as Prime Minister, where there was really the sense that there was this sort of Franco-German Anglo axis at the heart of Europe. But since then, certainly, Britain's been on the sidelines.
No, I don't think it's been on the sidelines. It certainly hasn't been part of a Franco-German Anglo axis, which was very short-lived. But I think, yes, it has acted as a very useful counterweight and as a magnet for other like-minded countries. The problem increasingly has slipped from being Germany. German attitudes to Europe have shifted a great deal over the last decade and are shifting rapidly now under the impact of the immigration crisis. It's been France and other Latin countries who, it turns out, have got quite a different view of the future of Europe from most Northern Europeans. And it has tended to be the UK that articulated the counter view to that.
Okay, we're going to move on to our final topic of the day. The falling price of oil has hit many nations around the world, but not least Russia. The country is staring down another year of recession after relying on oil and gas returns for more than half of its budget in 2014. The official list of companies set for privatisation is yet to be released, but it's understood to potentially include shipping firm Sovcomflot, oil company Rosneft, state bank VTB, and of course everyone's favourite national flag carrier Aeroflot. Cathy, are you taking out your wallet, thinking about what you want to invest in?
Gosh, I haven't been able to narrow it down just yet, although John and I were talking about it, and we agreed our primary hope would be for the Russian railways, that well-known symbol of the developed nation. I really do like Rosneft. When I think what they did over there to foreign investors, BP, for example, ripping out assets and fields that belonged to foreign investors, I find it very difficult to see anyone willing to place their bets again on any of those companies. Never, doesn't really matter how well run they are, and we all have our own opinions on that. Aeroflot is a good one. I mean, how much of your $500 million do you want to put on one of those companies?
Well, this is the problem, John, isn't it? That it's all very well Russia saying, well, we want to privatise, and we'll get on to what happened last time privatised as well. But there is this issue of, you know, there is a terrible recent track record for companies that have invested in Russia. They have all come home without their clothes.
Yes, absolutely. That's the first big issue. I mean, I can't see BP ever going back to Russia in any kind of scale. And everybody will have been discussing what happened around the golf courses of not just Europe, but also North America. And I just can't see anybody coming forward. That's the first problem. The second is that a lot of these companies are simply unsaleable. I mean, just now, as a joke, you asked Kathleen whether she was going to sort of open her wallet and buy one of these companies. I've got about £20 in my pocket. That's probably about what Russian Railways is worth. You know, this is burdened with enormous debt, hideously inefficient, needs fantastic amounts of money to modernise it and turn it into any kind of commercially viable company. No one's going to do it. This is a myth.
What about China? What about China? Do you think this is a chance for China to absorb some of the Russian...
China's broke. China can't do this.
Well, this comes to the problem, again, as we were discussing last week with Iran when it was on its grand tour of France and Italy. It's like, well, who's got money that can actually buy up things at the moment?
Malaysian Prime Minister?
You said that, not me. Cathy, the other thing is as well, let's look at what happened last time Russia privatised lots of its assets. We ended up with a lot of very suspiciously very rich oligarchs.
We certainly did, and a lot of them are now in London with very suspiciously big houses, and a lot of London being a major money laundering centre. No, it was awful. I mean, and that's what a lot of Russians remember as well as what happened to the assets then. I think probably because the prime minister then, Yeltsin, was perhaps not always on the case in the way that Putin...
He was on a certain type of case, but...
Yeah, well, I know. You said that, not me. That I think it will not be quite as devil may care as it was the first time. That doesn't mean it's not going to be just as, how shall we say, not necessarily on top of the table.
John Everard, then, if Russia can't sell off its assets in this way, what does it do? Because its economy is in no great shape whatsoever, is it?
I'm sure that a lot of people in the Kremlin are asking themselves exactly that question right now. It hasn't got many options left. We ought to note, too, that even if all these privatizations go ahead, giggle, giggle, that is going to raise about $6.5 billion. Given the scale of Russia's economic woes, this is a drop in the ocean. I mean, it doesn't even start to solve the problem. Where does Russia go from here? It doesn't have any answers. It has nothing to export apart from primary commodities. The prices of all of which, not just the oil and gas, have gone right through the floor. It is trying to support one hot and three cold wars, which is an expensive business. I mean, just the munitions it must be sort of draining its economy. It is a horrible mess and nobody can see a way out.
Do you think then, Cathy, it's possible in the next 12 months we might see Russia stepping back somewhat from Syria, from eastern Ukraine, and consolidating a bit more?
And perhaps from off the Scottish coast as well. Putin's driving foreign policy is reestablishing Russia as a great power that is respected and indeed feared. I think a lot will be sacrificed for that. And it does not appear that there's very much a danger of an uprising in Russia. I think he's got a way to go before he actually is going to plunge away from this particular. And money will be, you can always print it.
You can indeed. We'll leave it there. John Everard, Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is here next. Then at 1900, it's Section D, our design and architecture programme. The Monocle Daily, as I mentioned, 2200. Do tune in to that for Tom and Sasha in Iowa. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.